Viking believes that a journey on the rivers of the world can be an experience designed for the thinking person. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Learn how to plan, invest, and live smarter with the Raymond James For What It's Worth podcast. Featuring insights from leading professionals, you'll get the latest in wealth management, market commentary, and engaging research. Listen today at raymondjames.com/podcast.
I'm Jace Laycobb, and you're listening to Masterpiece Studio. This week on Les Miserables, 10 more years have passed, and Valjean and a now teenaged Cosette are living in a Parisian convent, while Javert, now in charge of the capital city's police force, continues to hunt his ever-elusive quarry.
What was my mother like?
Don't make me speak of it. She was one of my workers, and I dismissed her.
What for?
For nothing, for concealing the truth.
Here to discuss the narrative time jump and simmering political and personal tensions in Les Miserables is writer Andrew Davis. Davis has been one of the United Kingdom's most prolific screenwriters, bringing his sumptuous adaptations of titles as varied as Middlemarch and Little Dorrit to Masterpiece for decades. Davis is already on the job for his next big Masterpiece series, a bold new adaptation and completion of Jane Austen's tragically unfinished final novel, Sanditon. But with a few more episodes of Les Miserables to go, he offers a preview of the upcoming conclusion of his French revolutionary drama series.
Sometimes it's the best not to kind of explain it to the audience, just to say, you know, here it is. This moved and also baffled me. You know, let's see what you make of it.
Davis joins Masterpiece to talk Sanditon, the morals of Les Miserables, and his remarkable legacy as a true master of screenwriting.
And this week we are joined by Les Miserables writer Andrew Davis. Welcome.
Thank you.
What drew you to adapting Victor Hugo's Les Miserables, and why is now the perfect time for such an adaptation of that specific book?
It's a big, daunting kind of thing, and it probably wouldn't be something that I'd have voluntarily just suggested to anybody. It's not really my kind of book in the sense that Jane Austen is my kind of author, because I'm reading it in translation. Its great virtues are not to do with subtleties and wit and, you know, the little varieties of human behavior. It's a big kind of book. It reminds me of the Bible, you know? It's so strong, it's so iconic. It was suggested to me, and I read it, and I was kind of bowled over by the strength of it, and also by the sonorities and the echoes of, like, the world we live in today, a divided society, certainly as far as UK and France are concerned, but maybe America as well, in which there are the haves and the have-nots, and this is a book predominantly about the have-nots. It seemed very apposite and contemporary to do this book now.
True or false, your tagline for the project was "Nobody sings."
That's true, yes. Yes, that's right. We came across that quite early on.
You were quoted in The Telegraph as saying that this adaptation, quote, will rescue Victor Hugo's novel from the clutches of that awful music with its doggerel lyrics. Fans of the musical and some of its cast members were not pleased with your words. How do you react to their retorts?
Well, I mean, of course they were. I was very rude about the musical, but, you know, you have to say what you think, don't you? You have to be honest. I know a lot of people love the musical, but I thought it was a very feeble attempt to represent the novel. I completely accept that other people disagree with me. That's the way it is, isn't it?
This version of Les Misérables, sans singing, gives us instead backstories on Fantine and Jean Valjean. We're privy to different sides of these characters, a light-hearted, romantic Fantine, a raging, almost feral Valjean.
How could I not have a heart full of bitterness and hatred? I'd like to see you, after 19 years in the hulks, so don't preach to me about God and love.
Yeah, I beg your pardon. Forgive me. I should have considered your feelings.
Was it important to you to focus the first episode on these untold stories?
Oh, yes. And I like the way you characterize Jean Valjean as raging, almost feral. Yes, sure. I think that, in a way, comes from my first encounter with Les Misérables was when I was a little boy. I had a book called, you know, Great Stories from the Classics, and it was little potted extracts, and it was the story of the bishop's candlesticks. And I thought, you know, this poor bishop, here comes this terrifying figure who's hardly human. He's so rough and so rude. And I found it quite hard to understand the behaviour of the bishop, and also the behaviour of Jean Valjean after the bishop had been so kind. You know, I thought surely he should be terribly grateful. Instead, he robs the bishop. And then the bishop not only forgives him, but gives him more things. And that kind of puzzled me. But I wanted to preserve that sense of, and it comes across in the book, I think, of how frightened people are of Valjean, because he's a man of extraordinary power and strength, and he's so resentful against society because what society has done to him, that I wanted to keep that frightening aspect of him. And that gets echoed later on in the story, when he takes Cosette out to see the dawn rising over the gates of Paris, but it turns out that really he wants her to see the convicts.
Can they really be men?
Yes, they're men. They're men like me. Cosette.
I think if I crossed paths with one of those men, I would die, just from looking him in the face.
It's so strange. It's not like kind of novels that you normally read, is it? It's like something, it's like a kind of sort of mystical, religious tale that's more than a book. You know, you could live your life by that, this book, somehow.
You could. I mean, it's about a monster who becomes a man and a man who becomes a monster.
Yeah.
And sort of the inherent complexities of humanity therein. It's interesting to me because we get a glimpse of Fantine. Traditionally, we sort of picture her as sort of a tragic sex worker. We get to see her entire backstory here. She's given entirely new dimensions. Javert, however, still remains a bit of a mystery. Did you consider filling in his backstory at all? I mean, we get the fact that he was raised in a prison, but to see that additional dimension.
Yeah, it would mean going too far back, too far back in flashback or whatever. Yeah, I could have done it. And one of the strange things that struck us, somebody reminded me when we'd been developing the story for some time, somebody said, Valjean and Javert both seem to be virgins, which is so extraordinary. Here are two mature men, and we don't have any account of either of them having a loving relationship or a sexual relationship. Maybe sex is unimportant to Javert. And then, having met Jean Valjean, he gets so annoyed with him that this develops into a kind of obsession, which is like a twisted love affair. And it's like Jean Valjean doesn't seem interested in Javert at all, except as part of the forces that he's fighting against. And once he gets out of prison, he never gives Javert another thought until Javert comes into his world and starts tormenting him.
Well, that's one man out of hundreds. That was a decade ago. They've been dead for years.
No. No. I am convinced that he is still alive and here in Paris, laughing at us. I shall never be at peace until he is back in chains.
And one of the things I did in the adaptation, I think, was because I just couldn't believe that coincidence that Javert would turn up. And then having turned up, that neither of them would recognise each other. I mean, that's where Hugo has it in the story. And I think, well, actually, and it makes it much richer if you think that Javert has heard about this guy and he thinks, I bet he's that guy who I had in jail. And I bet he's been committing crimes all the time. And I just want to see him again. And I want to trap him and I want to nail him. And I want to get him in my power. And so so then it becomes a situation where they both know, but neither of them is letting on. And Javert is just waiting for Jean Valjean to reveal himself.
You've become known as a master of adaptations. You once said it gave you a wicked thrill to cut down War and Peace. Are there any sacred cows when it comes to adapting fiction?
No, I don't think so. But I'm aware that these great books are not called great books for nothing. I mean, these guys knew what they were doing. So I do respect the excellence of the original. But having said that, an adaptation is my take on them. It's not the definitive one necessarily, but I think it's my job and my duty to give my reading of a book, not just try to humbly prostrate myself before the great author.
Given that you're adapting rather colossal tomes for the screen, how do you prioritize or decide what makes it in and what doesn't?
I do a thing at the beginning after a first reading or my most recent rereading, if I've read it long ago in the past, ask myself, what really is the story here? Whose story is it? Who do we love? Who do we need to keep at the forefront of our minds, and base the whole adaptation around those two questions.
And how much of that decision-making is personal versus thinking about what the audience might want or need?
Entirely personal. obviously, I'm concerned about the audience, but the audience is something very amorphous, and I think of the first audience as being me. I want to write something that I would like to see and that I would enjoy seeing. And there's something that I think most people wouldn't realise, which is that the first people that see it, the people that I'm working closely with, and they're three or four very clever, very sympathetic, very clued up young people who are decades and decades younger than me and close behind pleasing myself. I want to please them, and I don't think of the audience in general. I think when I'm writing it, have I got it right for myself? And then I think, oh, Laura's going to laugh at this. Will's going to be moved by that. So those thoughts are quite uppermost in my mind.
Before this next question, a brief word from our sponsors.
All Veranda staterooms. Every day, a new view. Viking, offering a small ship experience on the world's oceans and a shore excursion in every port. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Coming up next on Masterpiece on PBS, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office continues Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, followed by the finale of Alice and Jack at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central.
Now, this week's episode moves the action forward to 1832. We find a teenage Cosette and Jean Valjean still living at the convent. How did you decide where to place the time jump in the series? Was there always a notion that it would be at sort of a natural halfway point?
I think Hugo himself helps us here. I mean, he did this. We don't get a lot of detail about how Cosette goes from age 6 or 7 to 16 or 17. We find her, again, a fully changed character from being this abused little girl who's clearly a survivor. And little Cosette is somebody who, when she's shown love, reciprocates, and she hasn't been too damaged by all the abuse she suffered. And they have one of those almost idealized, perfect father-daughter relationships. I invested a lot of emotion myself. I'm the father of a daughter in it. And there's a brief period in a girl's life when her father is just everything, and she falls in love with you, and then she's going to gradually, change. And of course, Jean Valjean, who's known no love in his life before, I mean, can't bear it that this is going to change.
You mentioned briefly earlier about Javert happening onto Montreuil, where Jean Valjean just happens to have set himself up. Les Miserables relies rather heavily on coincidence. Marius ends up in Valjean and Cosette's old flat next to the Thénardiers, whom his father told him saved him during the war. Cosette ends up with the doll made of her dead mother's hair. Should these occurrences be read as coincidence or as providence?
Well, I think, again, as I said before, this is one of those books. It's not like an ordinary book. I've tried to sort out or explain or get away from some of the coincidences. But I guess some of the things in the book you've just got to understand. We don't know for definite that the doll is made out of her mother's hair, but it might be, because it could be the same guy. I mean, he goes around the country. I'm buying and I'm selling. I'm selling and I'm buying. And the teeth and the hair get redistributed again and again.
Marius meets Eponine, and she tries to tempt him through a peephole in the wall. His romantic attraction to Cosette is complicated by a sexual desire for Eponine, which culminates in a, we'll say, vivid dream he has. What were your intentions with this scene and with Marius's sense of guilt?
Well, I was just fascinated by Eponine and her character, and just her juxtaposition with Marius at this stage. In the book, Marius is just such a po-faced puppet, really. And I wanted, to make him more like a real young man who's been, I mean, in a way, like most of the kids in this book, he's been abused. His upbringing was ridiculously privileged, but he's been brought up as a kind of little fascist, really. And he's worked out for himself that, with some prompting, that his grandfather's view is biased and crazy, and that he's got to work out his own things. And of course, here's this girl who's possibly a teenage prostitute. It's never absolutely clear what she does. And she's living next door and she likes him. And I just think I always look, if I can find it, any sources for humour in these sort of grand, iconic books. And the situation where he has this pure romantic love for Cosette, but there's this girl next door who's sort of tempting him physically, And so I couldn't resist giving him an erotic dream about the wrong girl. You know, he wants to have a dream about Cosette, which is all kind of pure and kissy-kissy. Instead, he finds she's changing into Eponine, who has a more kind of direct and visceral appeal, I suppose, for him. Though from Eponine's point of view, Eponine has a kind of pure attraction for Marius. She just thinks he's lovely, and she'd do anything for him. I mean, he's a different kind of boy from the kind of boys she's known.
There's a massive fight sequence between Valjean and the Thénardiers and their criminal associates who ambush him, and ultimately Javert shows up as well.
You dare to threaten my Cosette? You think you could do anything to impress me? Look! Now do your worst!
How difficult was it to write this pivotal action sequence?
I thought it was difficult because it's so strange in the book, and the most vivid thing in all this encounter is that he allows himself to be overpowered and bound, and then, I mean, his superhuman strength is a given in the story. Mm-hmm. So he throws them all off and proceeds to take this iron out of the fire and wound himself with it in order to demonstrate how puny any effort to frighten him by that kind of thing would be. So it's you keep getting these things that are, you know, not rational and not logical, and something like a kind of mystical text.
I mean, it is
that
the craziest
we need
thing
to reflect on and say, what could that mean?
That moment is the craziest of all the craziness, because he does burn himself. It is a demonstration of sort of his strength and his fearsomeness, and it sort of is that moment where he allows sort of the monster to come out that he's been containing. It is sort of his true self. I mean, what were you trying to convey with that precise action?
I was just trying to, I don't know, represent that episode in the book, I think. And it was something that I found, you know, very powerful and moving, but hard to understand. And sometimes, you know, it's the best not to kind of explain it to the audience, just to say, you know, here it is. This moved and also baffled me. You know, let's see what you make of it.
And we have an Andrew Davis adaptation of Jane Austen's Sanditon on the horizon. Austen only read about 100 pages of that fragment. Was it challenging or liberating getting to finish an unfinished work of Jane Austen?
Well, it was both challenging and liberating. It's odd. It's just a fragment. It's quite a long fragment. I would imagine she would have ruthlessly edited the 100 or so pages that she wrote, because I found that there was enough for half the first episode, but that was all in her 100 pages. But she did get to introduce the characters and set out the situation. And that was a really bold departure for Jane Austen, because the situation is the transformation of a little seaside village into a fashionable seaside resort, like Brighton or somewhere like that. And the characters are, again, a departure. Of course, we've got our young heroine, who is a fairly typical Jane Austen heroine. She's a bit like a rather more clued-up version of Catherine Morland out of Northanger Abbey. She's come from a large family, which she's the oldest girl, so she's quite sussed out about farm life and looking after her younger sisters. But she gets pushed into a new world with a lot of different people who are different from all the sorts of people that she's known before. And crucially, these main people, they're not aristocrats or gentlemen farmers. They are business people. They're entrepreneurs. They want to make a new world and make themselves some money. And, you know, that's different from all Jane Austen's characters before. And so a lot of the novel is about things like raising money, attracting celebrities, trying to build momentum. Oh, you know, it's so modern. And also it's got Jane Austen's first black character, who's an heiress from the West Indies with a fortune. I've said it was £100,000, which is huge for those days. But it makes it so, on the one hand, she will encounter, of course, a lot of prejudice because this is an England seaside village. No one will ever seen a black person before. But on the other hand, whoever marries her is going to be set up for life. So that's an interesting situation. And then you've got the local rich lady who's got lots of money that she might leave to this person or this person or this person. And so you've got several people who are after her money. And of course, our entrepreneurial family of brothers need her money as an investment. And so we go. Wonderful situation, I think, to start a story, and very liberating to write it. And also, I was very, very much in mind that this Regency period where it's set, she set it, I think, she was writing it in 1820, so I thought, let's go for 1820, which was late Regency period. A period of extreme kind of looseness in society, really. It was much more dissolute than actually we've got today. Jane Austen knew all about that stuff, but she always kept it below the surface with discreet references. And we're not going to be so discreet.
I'd expect nothing less. Andrew Davis, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Masterpiece viewers already on the edge of their seats, thanks to season 3 of Unforgotten, won't want to miss next week's podcast, where we go behind the scenes with this season's horrific killer, as DCI Cassie Stewart and DI Sunny Khan catch their prey.
Ticket was issued at 6:20 a.m. on the A405.
Which is where?
6 miles outside of Mittenham.
Was he heading to or from?
From.
That's next Sunday, May 12th, following the explosive third season finale of Unforgotten. Masterpiece Studio is hosted by me, Jace Lacob, and produced by Nick Anderson. Alicia Baitoup is our editor. Suzanne Simpson is our executive producer. The executive producer of Masterpiece is Rebecca Eaton. Sponsors for Masterpiece on PBS are Viking Cruises, Raymond James, and the Masterpiece Trust. Masterpiece Studio is officially a Webby Awards nominee for 2024. We are honored to be considered among such talented competition, but we need your vote. Head over to vote.webbyawards.com and vote for Masterpiece Studio in the podcast section, where you'll find us listed in the general television and film category. Voting closes Thursday, April 18th, so be sure to get your vote in soon. That's vote.webbyawards.com. Thank you.